today, you will notice that in your bulletin you have a pink sheet. I would invite you to pull that out because we are going to refer to it. So first, I'd like to tell you a little story about a friend of mine. We were all traveling when I was younger, and at a certain point, we ended up at a hotel, and we were all hanging out in the pool in the hot tub late in the afternoon. And there was a whole bunch of people there, families, parents, kids, whatever. And there was a young woman who caught my friend's eye. She was cute, let me tell you. 101 pounds of fun wearing a little polka dot bikini. And so he made his move. He went over and he started talking to her and chatting with her. And I eventually found himself in the hot tub with her and her parents because she was a teenager. And even got an arm around her. And I thought, wow, he's doing pretty good. You know, our parents are sitting right there, and, you know, he's chatting with them too. And that was great. And then later that night, we all went out to dinner. And after dinner, we decided to walk around town. We were in Ashland, Oregon, and it was a warm night. There were a lot of people out, and my friend was a guitar player. He'd brought his guitar, and he was still learning, but he liked to carry it around with him, partly so he could practice at the drop of a hat, but also because I think it made him look cool. He thought it made him look cool to carry a guitar around, impress the women. So he saw some street musicians hanging out, sitting on the street, playing their guitars. And this was in the grunge phase. Remember when the grunge was in? And everybody wore ratted jeans and kind of scraggy flannel t-shirt or flannel shirts, you know, combat boots and this kind of stuff. Well, that's what these folks were wearing. That's what he was wearing. And so he sat down and asked if he could play with them. And they said, sure. And so there were a couple guitarists there and a little bongo. And he joined the band. And he thought that was really cool, really cool to be able to sit down and pick up his guitar and play with this band. And what he did not realize was that these weren't just street musicians. These were homeless men. They were panhandling. And he hung out with them, and they were all dressed the same. He thought, you know, these were peers. You know, he hung out with them. And they played, and they had a good time, and people threw money in the cup, and he was just thrilled. And then guess who walked by? Yeah, little Miss Polka Dot Bikini walked by with her parents. And they glanced over, and he saw her, and he was playing his guitar, and he thought this was great. Now she could see him in his element playing his guitar. And he looked up, and he gave her one of those looks. You know what I'm talking about, ladies? One of these, right? One of these little raised eyebrow. He caught her eye, and the parents, the father, put his arm around his daughter and took her off in the other direction. Right in the other direction. And you could see the look on his face thinking, who let a street urchin into the hotel? That's exactly what he was thinking. Who let a street urchin into the hotel? My brother still did not realize why they had that reaction. He could not understand. So a little bit later, as they were all getting ready to go, the gentleman offered to split the cup with him. And that's when he realized, he's like, no, you keep the money. He says, no, you'll need it for a place to stay tonight. And he said, no, I have a place to stay tonight, don't you? And they said, no, we don't. We're going to go find a place in that alley. And he said, oh, my goodness, are you homeless? And to this, the gentleman replied in a great line. He said, well, I would never say this street ain't a home, but I am houseless. And there was a real moment there where they realized, you know, there's playing for fun and there's playing for food. There's playing for find a place to sleep. And the stigma attached to that, when he was a hotel guest, he was just fine to associate with their daughter. But if he did not have a place to stay, he was something frightening, something dangerous. So today we're learning about the parable of the talents. And David was right in pointing out that in the story of Luke, they talk about a mina, or a pound, which is about 3 months' salary. In the book of Matthew, we have the same story, minus a few details, the same story, and they talk about talents. And in that one, let me tell you, a talent was an extraordinary sum of money. A talent, one talent, would be the entire budget for a reasonable-sized city. Now, I want you to think about the city of San Rafael and what their annual budget is for the entire city. So if someone just gave you that amount of money and said, would you just hold on to this for me? I got to go someplace. I'll be back. What if someone gave you 10 times that amount? Like in cash. Here's a bag full of gold bullion. Could you just hang on to this for me? I'll be back. It was a huge amount of money. Huge amount of money. And this story has often been interpreted in two ways. The first is as an allegory, where they assume that this is God's way of telling us that we need to be fruitful with our funds and multiply it as much as possible. That is often how it is preached. The other way is where they take the word talent and assume that it means what it means in English, which is your gifts, your abilities, your skills, and talks about how, and usually the interpretation given is, God gives us gifts and abilities and talents. Are we using them effectively, or are we wasting them, burying them, hiding them, and not sharing them with the world? Does that make sense? Have people here heard one of those two interpretations or both at some point? Yeah? Okay. All right. Well, what we notice between these two stories is that there's a few key details that appear in the book of Luke, but not in the book of Matthew. Other than that, the story is pretty much the same. And so on the first side of your paper, the full side, you will see on the right-hand side, on the Lucan side, that I have highlighted the differences. So I'm just going to read those to you just very briefly. If you just take the highlighted parts, just the additional details, and put them together, you'll see something very interesting emerge. So he said, a nobleman went to a distant country to get royal power for himself and then return. But the citizens of his country hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to rule over us. When he returned, having received royal power, I'm going to turn the page, and I'm going to skip all the way to the bottom, where it says verse 27. But as for these enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and slaughter them in my presence. Now, we all know what an allegory is. Is that correct? We all know what an allegory is? When we're telling one story about a real thing, but we're changing the names a bit so that we don't actually label them. Like if I said, once upon a time there was a great king that loved to feed people, and on his crown he had two golden arches. Would you know what I'm talking about? Is there anybody here who does not know what I'm talking about? What about if I said, once upon a time, there was a great king. He wore a big top hat. And he once said, set all my prisoners free. And then the country split. And the kingdom was divided. And they fought, and they fought, and they fought, and they fought. The blue and the gray. Is there any question what I'm talking about? Okay. So I have mentioned to you before about a man named Archelaus. He was a relative, a descendant of Herod. We've heard about Herod's. Herod was the one that the three wise men went to, and then he tried to find out where baby Jesus was, and he had the horrible edict. Well, Archelaus was the one that came in after him. And Archelaus was a terrible leader. He was very corrupt. He had secret police. He stormed the temple on a high holy day because he was afraid of an insurrection, and he killed a bunch of people. And he did all of this before he was officially commissioned by Rome to be the governor of that area. He still had to go to Rome. He was effectively ruling after Herod, but he still had to go to Rome to get power from Caesar. Caesar had to officially bless his governorship. So he went to Rome. And when he went, a bunch of the Jewish population followed after him to petition the Caesar not to do this, to talk about his corruption, to talk about his cruelty, to talk about his violence, and say, please, anybody but him. Well, Caesar listened, thanked them for their time and for their thoughts, and then did it anyway. He made him governor over all of these people, and then sent him back to rule over Judea. And when he got there, the first thing he did was call in, have arrested all of the people that had followed and protested him, and he had them all killed. Now, if you were living in this time period and you heard these little details, so he said a nobleman went to distant country to get royal power for himself and then return, but the citizens of his country hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to rule over us. But as for these enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and slaughter them in my presence. Would you have any difficulty understanding what Christ is talking about. This happened during his lifetime. Okay? So, when we ask ourselves whether or not this is an allegory, and oftentimes it is seen as an allegory where the master is God, and then the servants are various members of the Jewish population or the Greek population or the Roman population, does that allegory fit? No. If they're talking about the master in comparison to Archelaus, is he a good guy or a bad guy? He's a bad guy. He's a bad guy. Okay, so let's keep that in mind. So a couple of other pieces of information. Let's talk about Jewish law for just a minute, because there were Jewish laws regarding money and what you could do with it and how you had to treat it if someone lent it to you. Did you know that? There are rules around that. Like, for example, if someone had to go someplace and couldn't hold their own money and asked you to hold it for them, well, you would worry about liability. What if it gets stolen? What if it gets lost? Something like that. Well, here's what you could do. You had two options. One, you could wrap it in a piece of cloth and hide it someplace, like in the back of a closet. Or you could bury it in the ground. Those were two acceptable things. And if for some reason it was stolen or it was lost or the house burned down and the money was lost, if you had wrapped it in cloth and hid it in a closet or buried it under the ground, you were covered. No one could blame you for the loss of the funds because you had done what was right under the law to protect it. You understand that? Okay, so let's look and see what he does in the book of Matthew. In the book of Matthew, he says, hold on a second. Okay, in verse 18, it says, the one who had received the one talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. And in the book of Luke, he says in verse 20, Lord, here is your pound. I wrapped it up in a piece of cloth. So what is that? That servant that's called wicked and useless, what did he do? He followed the law. He did what was right under the law. And how many people know what usury means? Have you heard of usury? You know where those laws come from? The idea of usury? It's from the Bible. Because in Jewish law, in the Bible, it said you are not allowed to charge people interest. You are not allowed to charge people interest. If someone lends you money, you pay it back, and that's enough. To charge someone interest is called usury, and you couldn't do that. So when the master says, the least you could have done is put it in the bank, and I could have gotten some interest from it, we see that there is a completely diametrically opposed system here. Two systems that don't work well together. One is following the law, one is respecting the money, one is honoring other people, and the other one is make as much as possible, no matter what. Ignore the law. And if you follow the law, you're somehow not doing enough. And when we look at people's attitudes at that time, it was one thing if you worked really hard over your life and you slowly built up and you slowly accumulated. That's one thing. That's reasonable. People can work hard. You can get a little bit ahead. Not super far ahead, but you can get a little bit ahead. But if someone gives you 10 talents, this extraordinary sum of money, and in a couple of months you have doubled it, they would wonder how you did that. How did you do that and maintain your integrity? How did you do that honestly, really? How did you do that without exploiting people? To get that much money, you had to get it from somewhere. Who did you take it away from? And what consequences did they suffer as a result of that? There would be a lot of suspicion around that. So in the book of Matthew, and that community was a poorer community, to hear about 10 talents, 5 talents suddenly being doubled overnight, that would have raised a lot of alarm. How did they do that? Something's wrong with this picture. Something's wrong with these servants. Something's wrong with this master. So, in Luke's community, they were a much wealthier community. And in Matthew's community, it was a poorer community. So in Matthew's community, when they talk about this master yelling at the servant and his reply, you are a master who is cruel, and you reap what you did not sow. Do you hear that? You reap what you did not sow. You did not work for this, but you get to get all of the benefits. You did not actually make any of the effort. You're just collecting all of the good stuff. He's talking about an attitude that was around in that time period. What? How did you get on? And we still have it to this day. Unless you win the lottery, how did you make so much money so fast? Something's not right here. So, in Matthew's community, simply talking about the amount of money and saying reaping and sowing, you reaped what you did not sow, would be enough for them to know who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, and the message of the text. In the Lucan community, to be throwing around those amounts of money wouldn't have been that big of a deal. It wouldn't have been enough for them to notice, you know, what the message is supposed to be. And so Luke adds these details, the allegorical details about Archelaus, so that everybody knows. There's no question, because everybody knew Archelaus was not a good leader. He was a corrupt leader. So anyone in Luke's community would be very clear when this parable is being told, this is who the good guy is and this is who the bad guy is, and let's just be very clear about that to get to the message of the text. Now, the message of the text is in the very, very end. Is in the very end. We have this famous line. Now, we've heard this before. It's often taken out of context. And it's in verse 29 of Matthew and in verse 26 of Luke. It's next to letter G if you're looking on the backside of the paper. For to those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. Who has heard this before? Yeah, this is very commonly used. And it's often used to talk about why we have poor. Well, if they would just try harder, if they wouldn't just bury their talents, if they would actually go to the work to try and make more money with the money that they have, they wouldn't have this problem. That's why the rich are rewarded and the poor are punished. This is a very common in conservative churches. We hear it a lot from a certain governmental party to justify not helping the poor, because this passage is ingrained in our culture, unfortunately. But when we look at the passage, knowing what we know now that we've put it into historical context, now that we know a little bit about Jewish law, now that we know in the story who's supposed to be the good example and who's supposed to be the bad example, let's look at this passage, this one little section. I tell you, to all those who have, more will be given, but from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. That's usually attributed to Christ. Most people would tell you, oh, well, you know what Christ says, so we don't have to help the poor. Who says this in the story? Take a minute and look. Who says this in the story? The bad guy says this in the story. The bad guy says this. Yeah. And to some degree, it is true. Unfortunately, those who have a lot tend to just get more and more and more. And those who have very little, oftentimes even that is taken away. When I first discovered this, I learned this from Richard Rohrbach. He was my New Testament professor back in 2007 or 8. Around that time, San Francisco had a new policy for dealing with homeless, though they did not publicize it. It came out as a dirty little secret later. What they did was they called it street cleansings. And they would, remember these? Some people are nodding. They know what I'm talking about. Well, they would go out in the middle of the night with fire hoses while people were sleeping in doorways. And they would wash the streets so that the tourists wouldn't have to see this. People ended up with broken bones, chipped teeth, severe bruises. But the streets were cleaned. It was a homeless policy. And the reason why that's important is because when we look at this story, what the master does right afterwards, after he gives his big accusation, is he throws the person out of the house. He throws the slave out of the house, which is important. It's devastating, because while we do not condone slavery in that society at that point, while that slave was in that household, he had shelter, he had food, right? And he had some sort of protection. But to suddenly be freed by an angry master would leave him with no shelter and no food. And it happened all the time. Can I tell you, it happened all the time. When people discovered that their slaves were not functioning to capacity, that they were not making as much money or doing as much work as they should be, even if they had been injured on the job, if they suddenly found themselves pregnant, if they were old and slowing down, they would free them in an act of kindness. It was called manumission. And just set them loose. Congratulations, you're free. Set them outside the house and not let them come back. And it happened all the time. Homelessness was a huge issue. Huge issue in ancient Israel. Because June was eviction month. Anybody who was behind on their rent, June was the time that they were kicked out. Anytime people were ill, if there was a contagious disease going around, people would take them out of the house and lay them in the streets. And so, you know, when we see what San Francisco was doing back in 2007, 2008, this is following along those lines of homeless are just a problem to be dealt with, not human beings that need to be assisted. And so what's fascinating about this time period is how the Christians responded. They followed Christ's example of helping people, of being brothers and sisters in Christ. And so they would go out into the streets, even when there was infectious diseases going around, even during eviction time. The populations, as we know, of early Christians were very, very high in newly freed slaves because they didn't have other places to go. Christians would go out into the street, and they would find people that were sick that had been laid out there by their families. And they would pick them up, and they would take them back to a large communal house, and they would feed them, and they would nurse them, and they would bring them back to health. And they would say, you know, I am your brother, which was a big deal because nowadays, you know, we call each other, hey, bro, this kind of stuff. You know, it's a term of affection. Back then, to call someone brother was very serious. It meant I'm taking you on as a blood relation. Everything that I have is yours. I will be your protector. I will be with you. I will treat you like family. And they found that as they did this, people started getting better. They got healthy again. They could become productive members of community. And their population grew. Their population grew. And that's how some of the first hospitals got started, was because that they were doing this and people were getting better. And so their ranks swelled. And that's how we have so many newly freed slaves and so many slaves that were in the original Christian communities. So I was thrilled yesterday as I was reading an article talking about San Francisco trying a new pilot program. Apparently, the fire hoses weren't as effective as they had hoped. There were still homeless in San Francisco, and they still had needs for food, shelter, clean water, and medical services. So after a few years of that, they are now trying something new. They are trying to bring entire homeless encampments indoors to give them permanent housing. And they're going to do it in a way that's going to allow couples to stay together instead of splitting them up into male and female housing as they often do, to allow families to stay together, to allow people with pets to be able to bring their pets too. Because they're learning, as different cities around the United States, in Utah, they're trying this. In Canada, they've tried this. When they simply take homeless people and give them permanent housing, the people get back on their feet much more quickly. They become contributing members of society much more quickly, and it costs an enormous amount less than it would to continually jail them, fine them, give them emergency room services, and help them to subsist through food pantries. And so we're seeing signs of hope. Did you guys see that article? Have you heard about this pilot program?
As a community.
They're going to try it with 400. There's a camp of 400 people. They're just going to bring them all in and invite them in. So the final thing that's fascinating about this to me, as they're talking about the parable of the talents, as they're talking about the minas and the pounds and what people are doing with them, you see what happens right after this. In the book of Matthew, they go straight into the parable of the sheep and the goats, where Christ tells people that you will be judged. It doesn't say anything about what you believe. You'll be judged by how you treat the least among you. This is where we get that phrase that I always use during the offertory prayer, right? When I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was a stranger, you welcomed me. When I was a prisoner, you visited me. This is what he goes into right after this this parable of the talents, he goes straight into it. You are judged by how you treat the least among you. And in the book of Luke, the wealthy community that was charging people interest, the very next thing that he talks about is going into the temple to overturn the money changers' tables. Lest there be any doubt in that community where Christ stood, he goes straight in to the people that were the exchangers. They were the bankers. They were the ones that would exchange money for money and charge them enormous amount of money, interest, to do it. And he goes in and he overthrows the tables just to drive that point home. So we have a proud tradition. We have a proud tradition when we look way back at how people were treated. About with the usury laws, with the early Christian communities, with the first hospitals. We have a proud tradition. And we carry that on as we work with the shelter dinners at rest, as we help individuals that come to our doors looking for help when they are homeless. Yeah, I have a discretionary fund that I can use a little here and there as people need it. As we have built Pilgrim Park to give people better alternatives to living on the street. It's a good thing. It's following Christ's example, and it's putting our money where our mouth is. And so I hope this has been informative to you, and I hope it has been helpful. I'll tell you, the person that I learned this from, Reverend Dr. Richard Werbach, he talked about this that he discovered with the Archelaus Connection at a huge conference for ministers from all over the country that he went to many years ago. And he was asked to present a paper, and so he brought this, and he talked about it to all of these ministers from all different denominations. And he said after he gave his paper talking about how the parable of the talents it just completely turned it on its head, he said after that, no one in the conference would talk to him. When he walked by groups of people that were chit-chatting in the halls, they would get real quiet, and he would hear people muttering, "Do you think he's a communist?" Really, because in this culture, you know, we are so focused on the dollar. We are so focused on accumulation. We're so focused on the concept that we can just, through sheer willpower, pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. And at a certain point, you know, we have taken what we believe about capitalism and we have put that as a sheen over what Christ is talking about, to the point that we can take something like this and honestly believe that it's an allegory, that God is telling us that if we're not taking our money and doubling it, you know, in 90 days' time, something's wrong with us. We're wicked and we're evil and we're useless and we're worthless. And at a certain point, we ask ourselves, are we creating a measuring stick and then, you know, shoehorning the Bible into it? Because the Bible is... If the Bible is the measuring stick, then we're pretty far from it as a culture. Does that make sense? And so he said of all of the ministers that came to that conference, they all stopped talking to him except for one. One guy came up to him and said, "Thank you for telling me that. I always knew there was something wrong with that passage. I always knew there was something wrong with that interpretation. And I so appreciate you letting me know." And he went straight back to his congregation, and that very next Sunday he preached on this. And by Thursday, he was fired. So, today's Sunday.
So council meeting is needed after church.
Council meeting is after church. Bible study's on Wednesday, so I got one more class, and then I'll just be on pins and needles. Can I get an amen to that? Amen.